What is it? What is it, you filthy pig? But Liesel, she said nothing. The apples, she thought happily. The apples. And she vomited one more time, for luck. The Aryan Shopkeeper. They stood outside Frau Diller's against the whitewashed wall. A piece of candy was in Liesel Memminger's mouth. The sun was in her eyes. Despite these difficulties, she was still able to speak and argue. Another conversation between Rudy and Liesel.
Hurry up, Saumensch. That's 10 already.
It's not. It's only 8. I've got 2 to go.
Well, hurry up then. I told you we should have gotten a knife and sawn it in half.
Come on, that's 2.
All right, here. And don't swallow it.
Do I look like an idiot?
A short pause.
This is great, isn't it?
It sure is, Saumensch. At the end of August and summer, they found 1 pfennig on the ground. Pure excitement. It was sitting half-rotten in some dirt on the washing and ironing route. A solitary, corroded coin.
Take a look at that!
Rudy swooped on it. The excitement almost stung as they rushed back to Frau Diller's, not even considering that a single pfennig might not be the right price. They burst through the door and stood in front of the Aryan shopkeeper, who regarded them with contempt.
I'm waiting,
she said. Her hair was tied back, and her black dress choked her body. The framed photo of the Führer kept watch from the wall.
Heil Hitler,
Rudy led.
Heil Hitler,
she responded, straightening taller behind the counter.
And you?
She glared at Liesel, who promptly gave her a Heil Hitler of her own. It didn't take Rudy long to dig the coin from his pocket and place it firmly on the counter. He looked straight into Frau Diller's spectacled eyes and said,
Mixed candy, please.
Frau Diller smiled. Her teeth elbowed each other for room in her mouth, and her unexpected kindness made Rudy and Liesel smile as well. Not for long. She bent down, did some searching, and came back.
Here,
she said, tossing a single piece of candy onto the counter.
Mix it yourself.
Outside, they unwrapped it and tried biting it in half, but the sugar was like glass. Far too tough even for Rudy's animal-like choppers. Instead, they had to trade sucks on it until it was finished. 10 sucks for Rudy, 10 for Liesel, back and forth. This, Rudy announced at one point with a candy-toothed grin, is the good life. And Liesel didn't disagree. By the time they were finished, both their mouths were an exaggerated red, and as they walked home, they reminded each other to keep their eyes peeled in case they found another coin. Naturally, they found nothing. No one can be that lucky twice in 1 year, let alone a single afternoon. Still, with red tongues and teeth, they walked down Himmel Street, happily searching the ground as they went. The day had been a great one. And Nazi Germany was a wondrous place. The Struggler continued. We move forward now to a cold night struggle. We'll let the book thief catch up later. It was November the 3rd, and the floor of the train held onto his feet. In front of him, he read from the copy of Mein Kampf, his savior. Sweat was swimming out of his hands. Finger marks clutched the book. Book Thief Productions officially presents Mein Kampf, My Struggle, by Adolf Hitler. Behind Max Vandenberg, the city of Stuttgart opened its arms in mockery. He was not welcome there, and he tried not to look back as the stale bread disintegrated in his stomach. A few times he shifted again and watched the lights become only a handful and then disappear altogether. Look proud, he advised himself. You cannot look afraid. Read the book. Smile at it. It's a great book, the greatest book you've ever read. Ignore that woman on the other side. She's asleep now anyway. Come on, Max. You're only a few hours away. As it had turned out, the promised return visit in the Room of Darkness didn't take days, It had taken a week and a half. Then another week till the next, and another, until he lost all sense of the passing of days and hours. He was relocated once more to another small storage room, where there was more light, more visits, and more food. Time, however, was running out.
"I'm leaving soon," his friend Walter Kugler told him. "You know how it is. The army."
"I'm sorry, Walter." Walter Kugler, Max's friend from childhood, placed his hand on the Jew's shoulder.
"It could be worse," he looked his friend in his Jewish eyes. "I could be you."
That was their last meeting. A final package was left in the corner, and this time there was a ticket. Walter opened Mein Kampf and slid it inside, next to the map he'd brought with the book itself.
"Page 13," he smiled. "For luck, yes? For luck."
And the two of them embraced.
When the door shut, Max opened the book and examined the ticket. Stuttgart to Munich to Passing. It left in 2 days, in the night, just in time to make the last connection. From there, he would walk. The map was already in his head, folded in quarters. The key was still taped to the inside cover. He sat for half an hour before stepping toward the bag and opening it. Apart from food, a few other items sat inside. The extra contents of Walter Kugler's gift. One small razor. A spoon, the closest thing to a mirror. Shaving cream. A pair of scissors. When he left it, the storeroom was empty but for the floor. "Goodbye," he whispered. The last thing Max saw was the small mound of hair sitting casually against the wall. "Goodbye." With a clean-shaven face and lopsided yet neatly combed hair, he had walked out of that building a new man. In fact, he walked out German. Hang on a second, he was German. Or more to the point, he had been. In his stomach was the electric combination of nourishment and nausea. He walked to the station. He showed his ticket and identity card, and now he sat in a small box compartment of the train, directly in danger's spotlight.
"Papers!"
That was what he dreaded to hear. It was bad enough when he was stopped on the platform. He knew he could not withstand it twice. The shivering hands, the smell, no, the stench of guilt. He simply couldn't bear it again. Fortunately, they came through early and only asked for the ticket, and now all that was left was a window of small towns, the congregations of lights, and the woman snoring on the other side of the compartment. For most of the journey, he made his way through the book, trying never to look up. The words lolled about in his mouth as he read them. Strangely, as he turned the pages and progressed through the chapters, it was only two words he ever tasted. Mein Kampf. My struggle. The title. Over and over again, as the train prattled on from one German town to the next. Mein Kampf. Of all the things to save him.
Tricksters. You could argue that Liesel Memminger had it easy. She did have it easy compared to Max Vandenberg. Certainly her brother practically died in her arms. Her mother abandoned her. But anything was better than being a Jew. In the time leading up to Max's arrival, another washing customer was lost. This time, the Weingartners. The obligatory schimpferei occurred in the kitchen, and Liesel composed herself with the fact that there were still two left, and even better, one of them was the mayor, the wife, the books. As for Liesel's other activities, she was still causing havoc with Rudi Steiner. I would even suggest that they were polishing their wicked ways. They made a few more journeys with Arthur Berg and his friends, keen to prove their worth and extend their thieving repertoire. They took potatoes from one farm, onions from another. Their biggest victory, however, they performed alone. As witnessed earlier,
One of the benefits of walking through town was the prospect of finding things on the ground. Another was noticing people, or, more important, the same people, doing identical things week after week. A boy from school, Otto Sturm, was one such person. Every Friday afternoon, he rode his bike to church, carrying goods to the priests. For a month, they watched him as good weather turned to bad, and Rudy in particular was determined that one Friday, in an abnormally frosty week in October, Otto wouldn't quite make it. "All those priests," Rudy explained as they walked through town. "They're all too fat anyway. They could do without a feed for a week or so." Liesl could only agree. First of all, she wasn't Catholic. Second, she was pretty hungry herself. As always, she was carrying the washing. Rudy was carrying two buckets of cold water, or as he put it, two buckets of future ice. Just before 2 o'clock, he went to work. Without any hesitation, he poured the water onto the road in the exact position where Otto would pedal around the corner. Liesl had to admit it. There was a small portion of guilt at first, but the plan was perfect, or at least as close to perfect as it could be. At just after 2 o'clock every Friday, Otto Sturm turned onto Munich Street with the produce in his front basket at the handlebars. On this particular Friday, that was as far as he would travel. The road was icy as it was, but Rudy put on the extra coat, barely able to contain a grin. It ran across his face like a skid. "Come on," he said, "that bush there." After approximately 15 minutes, the diabolical plan bore its fruit, so to speak. Rudy pointed his finger into a gap in the bush. "There he is." Otto came around the corner, dopey as a lamb. He wasted no time in losing control of the bike, sliding across the ice and lying face down on the road. When he didn't move, Rudy looked at Liesl with alarm. "Crucified Christ," he said, "I think we might have killed him." He crept slowly out, removed the basket, and they made their getaway. "Was he breathing?" Liesl asked, farther down the street. "Keine Ahnung," Rudy said, clinging to the basket. He had no idea. From far down the hill, they watched as Otto stood up, scratched his head, scratched his crotch, and looked everywhere for the basket. "Stupid Scheißkopf," Rudy grinned, and they looked through the spoils. Bread, broken eggs, and the big one, Speck. Rudy held the fatty ham to his nose and breathed it gloriously in. Beautiful. As tempting as it was to keep the victory to themselves, they were overpowered by a sense of loyalty to Arthur Berg. They made their way to his impoverished lodging on Kempfstrasse and showed him the produce. Arthur couldn't hold back his approval. "Who did you steal this from?" It was Rudy who answered. "Otto Sturm." "Well," he nodded, "whoever that is, I'm grateful to him." He walked inside and returned with a bread knife, a frying pan, and a jacket, and the three thieves walked the hallway of apartments. "We'll get the others," Arthur Berg stated as they made it outside. "We might be criminals, but we're not totally immoral." Much like the book thief, he at least drew the line somewhere. A few more doors were knocked on. Names were called out to apartments from streets below, and soon the whole conglomerate of Arthur Berg's fruit-stealing troop was on its way to the Amper. In the clearing on the other side, a fire was lit, and what was left of the eggs was salvaged and fried. The bread and Speck were cut. With hands and knives, every last piece of Otto Sturm's delivery was eaten. No priest in sight. It was only at the end that an argument developed regarding the basket. The majority of boys wanted to burn it. Fritz Hammer and Andy Schmeichel wanted to keep it, but Arthur Berg, showing his incongruous moral aptitude, had a better idea. "You two," he said to Rudy and Liesl, "maybe you should take it back to that Sturm character. I'd say that poor bastard probably deserves that much." "Oh, come on, Arthur." "I don't want to hear it, Andy." "Jesus Christ, he doesn't want to hear it either." The group laughed, and Rudi Steiner picked up the basket.
I'll take it back, and hang it on their mailbox.
He had walked only 20 meters or so when the girl caught up. She would be home far too late for comfort, but she was well aware that she had to accompany Rudi Steiner through town, to the Sturm farm on the other side. For a long time they walked in silence.
"Do you feel bad?"
Liesl finally asked. They were already on the way home.
"About what?" "You know."
"Of course I do. But I'm not hungry anymore, and I bet he's not hungry either. Don't think for a second that the priests would get food if there wasn't enough to go around at home.
He just hit the ground so hard.
Don't remind me." But Rudi Steiner couldn't resist smiling. In years to come, he would be a giver of bread, not a stealer. Proof again of the contradictory human being. So much good, so much evil. Just add water. 5 days after their bittersweet little victory, Arthur Berg emerged again and invited them on his next stealing project. They ran into him on Munich Street, on the way home from school on a Wednesday. He was already in his Hitler Youth uniform. "We're going again tomorrow afternoon. You interested?" They couldn't help themselves.
"Where?"
"The potato place." 24 hours later, Liesl and Rudi braved the wire fence again and filled their sack. The problem showed up as they made their getaway.
"Christ!" shouted Arthur. "The farmer!"
It was his next word, however, that frightened. He called it out as if he'd already been attacked with it. His mouth ripped open, the word flew out, and the word was axe. Sure enough, when they turned around, the farmer was running at them, the weapon held aloft. The whole group ran for the fence line and made their way over. Rudi, who was farthest away, caught up quickly, but not quickly enough to avoid being last. As he pulled his leg up, he became entangled.
"Hey!"
The sound of the stranded. The group stopped. Instinctively, Liesl ran back.
"Hurry up!"
Arthur called out. His voice was far away, as if he'd swallowed it before it exited his mouth. White sky. The others ran. Liesl arrived and started pulling at the fabric of his pants. Rudy's eyes were opened wide with fear.
"Quick," he said, "he's coming."
Far off, they could still hear the sound of deserting feet when an extra hand grabbed the wire and reefed it away from Rudi Steiner's pants. A piece was left on the metallic knot, but the boy was able to escape.
"Now move it,"
Arthur advised them, not long before the farmer arrived, swearing and struggling for breath. The axe held on now, with force, to his leg. He called out the futile words of the robbed.
"I'll have you arrested. I'll find you. I'll find out who you are."
That was when Arthur Berg replied.
"The name is Owens."
He loped away, catching up to Liesl and Rudi.
"Jesse Owens."
When they made it to safe ground, fighting to suck the air into their lungs, they sat down, and Arthur Berg came over. Rudi wouldn't look at him.
"It's happened to all of us," Arthur said, sensing the disappointment.
Was he lying? They couldn't be sure, and they would never find out. A few weeks later, Arthur Berg moved to Cologne. They saw him once more on one of Liesl's washing delivery rounds. In an alleyway off Munich Street, he handed Liesl a brown paper bag containing a dozen chestnuts. He smirked.
"A contact in the roasting industry."
After informing them of his departure, he managed to proffer a last pimply smile and to cuff each of them on the forehead.
"Don't go eating all those things at once, either."
And they never saw Arthur Berg again. As for me, I can tell you that I most definitely saw him. A small tribute to Arthur Berg, a still living man. The Cologne sky was yellow and rotting, flaking at the edges. He sat propped against a wall, with a child in his arms. His sister. When she stopped breathing, he stayed with her, and I could sense he would hold her for hours. There were 2 stolen apples in his pocket. This time they played it smarter. They ate one chestnut each and sold the rest of them door to door.
"If you have a few pfennig to spare," Liesel said at each house, "I have chestnuts."
They ended up with 16 coins.
"Now," Rudy grinned, "revenge."
That same afternoon, they returned to Frau Diller's, Heil Hitler'd, and waited.
"Mixed candy again?"
she schmunzelt, to which they nodded. The money splashed the counter, and Frau Diller's smile fell slightly ajar.
"Yes, Frau Diller," they said in unison. "Mixed candy, please."
The framed Führer looked proud of them. Triumph before the storm. The Struggler concluded. The juggling comes to an end now, but the struggling does not. I have Liesel Memminger in one hand, Max Vandenberg in the other. Soon I will clap them together. Just give me a few pages. The Struggler. If they killed him tonight, at least he would die alive. The train ride was far away now, the snorer most likely tucked up in the carriage she'd made her bed, travelling on. Now there were only footsteps between Max and survival. Footsteps and thoughts. And doubts. He followed the map in his mind, from passing to mulking. It was late when he saw the town. His legs ached terribly, but he was nearly there, the most dangerous place to be. Close enough to touch it. Just as it was described, he found Munich Street and made his way along the footpath. Everything stiffened. Glowing pockets of streetlights, dark, passive buildings. The town hall stood like a giant, ham-fisted youth, too big for his age. The church disappeared in darkness the farther his eyes travelled upward. It all watched him. He shivered. He warned himself, "Keep your eyes open." German children were on the lookout for stray coins. German Jews kept watch for possible capture. In keeping with the usage of number 13 for luck, he counted his footsteps in groups of that number. Just 13 footsteps, he would tell himself. Come on, just 13 more. As an estimate, he completed 90 sets, till at last he stood on the corner of Himmel Street. In one hand, he held his suitcase. The other was still holding Mein Kampf. Both were heavy, and both were handled with a gentle secretion of sweat. Now he turned onto the side street, making his way to number 33, resisting the urge to smile, resisting the urge to sob, or even imagine the safety that might be awaiting him. He reminded himself that this was no time for hope. Certainly he could almost touch it, he could feel it somewhere just out of reach. Instead of acknowledging it, he went about the business of deciding again what to do, if he was caught at the last moment, or if by some chance the wrong person awaited him inside. Of course, there was also the scratchy feeling of sin. How could he do this? How could he show up and ask people to risk their lives for him? How could he be so selfish? 33. They looked at each other. The house was pale, almost sick-looking, with an iron gate and a brown, spit-stained door. From his pocket, he pulled out the key. It did not sparkle, but lay dull and limp in his hand. For a moment, he squeezed it, half expecting it to come leaking toward his wrist. It didn't. The metal was hard and flat, with a healthy set of teeth, and he squeezed it till it pierced him. Slowly, then, the Struggler leaned forward, his cheek against the wood, and he removed the key from his fist. Part 4. The Standover Man. Featuring the accordionist, a promise keeper, a good girl, a Jewish fist fighter, the Wrath of Rosa, a lecture, a sleeper, the swapping of nightmares, and some pages from the basement. The accordionist.
The Secret Life of Hans Hubermann. There was a young man standing in the kitchen. The key in his hand felt like it was rusting into his palm. He didn't speak anything like hello, or please help, or any other such expected sentence. He asked two questions. Question one. Hans Hubermann? Question two. Do you still play the accordion? As he looked uncomfortably at the human shape before him, the young man's voice was scraped out and handed across the dark like it was all that remained of him. Papa, alert and appalled, stepped closer. To the kitchen, he whispered. Of course I do. It all dated back many years, to World War I. They're strange, those wars. Full of blood and violence, but also full of stories that are equally difficult to fathom. It's true, people will mutter. I don't care if you don't believe me. It was that fox who saved my life. Or, they died on either side of me and I was left standing there, the only one without a bullet between my eyes. Why me? Why me and not them? Hans Hubermann's story was a little like that. When I found it within the book thief's words, I realized that we passed each other once in a while during that period, though neither of us scheduled a meeting. Personally, I had a lot of work to do. As for Hans, I think he was doing his best to avoid me. The first time we were in the vicinity of each other, Hans was 22 years old, fighting in France. The majority of young men in his platoon were eager to fight. Hans wasn't so sure. I had taken a few of them along the way, but you could say I never even came close to touching Hans Hubermann. He was either too lucky, or he deserved to live, or there was a good reason for him to live. In the army, he didn't stick out at either end. He ran in the middle, climbed in the middle, and he could shoot straight enough so as not to affront his superiors. Nor did he excel enough to be one of the first chosen to run straight at me. A small but noteworthy note. I've seen so many young men over the years who think they're running at other young men. They are not. They're running at me. He'd been in the fight for almost 6 months when he ended up in France, where, at face value, a strange event saved his life. Another perspective would suggest that in the nonsense of war, it made perfect sense. On the whole, his time in the Great War had astonished him from the moment he entered the army. It was like a serial, day after day after day after day. The conversation of bullets, resting men, the best dirty jokes in the world, cold sweat, that malignant little friend, outstaying its welcome in the armpits and trousers. He enjoyed the card games the most, followed by the few games of chess, despite being thoroughly pathetic at it. And the music. Always the music. It was a man a year older than himself, a German Jew named Erich Vandenberg, who taught him to play the accordion. The two of them gradually became friends due to the fact that neither of them was terribly interested in fighting. They preferred rolling cigarettes to rolling in snow and mud. They preferred shooting craps to shooting bullets. A firm friendship was built on gambling, smoking, and music, not to mention a shared desire for survival. The only trouble with this was that Erich Vandenberg would later be found in several pieces on a grassy hill. His eyes were open, and his wedding ring was stolen. I shoveled up his soul with the rest of them, and we drifted away. The horizon was the color of milk, cold and fresh, poured out among the bodies. All that was really left of Erich Vandenberg was a few personal items and the fingerprinted accordion. Everything but the instrument was sent home. It was considered too big. Almost with self-reproach, it sat on his makeshift bed at the base camp and was given to his friend Hans Hubermann, who happened to be the only man to survive. He survived like this. He didn't go into battle that day. For that, he had Erich Vandenberg to thank, or more to the point, Erich Vandenberg
and the sergeant's toothbrush. That particular morning, not too long before they were leaving, Sergeant Stefan Schneider paced into the sleeping quarters and called everyone to attention. He was popular with the men for his sense of humor and practical jokes, but more so for the fact that he never followed anyone into the fire. He always went first. On certain days, he was inclined to enter the room of resting men and say something like, "Who comes from passing?" or "Who's good with mathematics?" or, in the fateful case of Hans Hubermann, "Who's got neat handwriting?" No one ever volunteered, not after the first time he did it. On that day, an eager young soldier named Philip Schlink stood proudly up and said, "Yes, sir, I come from passing." He was promptly handed a toothbrush and told to clean the shithouse. When the sergeant asked who had the best penmanship, you can surely understand why no one was keen to step forward. They thought they might be first to receive a full hygiene inspection or scrub an eccentric lieutenant's shit-trampled boots before they left. "Now come on," Schneider toyed with them. Slapped down with oil, his hair gleamed, though a small piece was always upright and vigilant at the apex of his head. "At least one of you useless bastards must be able to write properly." In the distance, there was gunfire. It triggered a reaction. "Look," said Schneider, "this isn't like the others. It will take all morning, maybe longer." He couldn't resist a smile. "Schlink was polishing that shithouse while the rest of you were playing cards, but this time you're going out there." Life or pride? He was clearly hoping that one of his men would have the intelligence to take life. Eric Vandenberg and Hans Hubermann glanced at each other. If someone stepped forward now, the platoon would make his life a living hell for the rest of their time together. No one likes a coward. On the other hand, if someone was to be nominated... Still, no one stepped forward, but a voice stooped out and ambled toward the sergeant. It sat at his feet, waiting for a good kicking. It said, "Hubermann, sir." The voice belonged to Eric Vandenberg. He obviously thought that today wasn't the appropriate time for his friend to die. The sergeant paced up and down the passage of soldiers. "Who said that?" He was a superb pacer, Stefan Schneider, a small man who spoke, moved, and acted in a hurry. As he strode up and down the two lines, Hans looked on, waiting for the news. Perhaps one of the nurses was sick, and they needed someone to strip and replace bandages on the infected limbs of injured soldiers. Perhaps 1,000 envelopes were to be licked and sealed, and sent home with death notices in them. At that moment, the voice was put forward again, moving a few others to make themselves heard. "Hubermann," they echoed. Eric even said, "Immaculate handwriting, sir. Immaculate." "It's settled, then." There was a circular, small-mouthed grin. "Hubermann, you're it." The gangly young soldier made his way forward and asked what his duty might be. The sergeant sighed. "The captain needs a few dozen letters written for him. He's got terrible rheumatism in his fingers, or arthritis. You'll be writing them for him." This was no time to argue, especially when Schlink was sent to clean the toilets, and the other one, Pfleger, nearly killed himself licking envelopes. His tongue was infection blue. "Yes, sir," Hans nodded. And that was the end of it. His writing ability was dubious, to say the least, but he considered himself lucky. He wrote the letters as best he could, while the rest of the men went into battle. None of them came back. That was the first time Hans Hubermann escaped me, the Great War. A second escape was still to come, in 1943, in Essen. Two wars for two escapes. Once young, once middle-aged. Not many men are lucky enough to cheat me twice. He carried the accordion with him during the entirety of the war. When he tracked down the family of Eric Vandenberg in Stuttgart upon his return, Vandenberg's wife informed him that he could keep it. Her apartment was littered with them, and it upset her too much to look at that one in particular.
The others were reminder enough, as was her once shared profession of teaching it.
"He taught me to play," Hans informed her, as though it might help. Perhaps it did, for the devastated woman asked if he could play it for her, and she silently wept as he pressed the buttons and keys of a clumsy Blue Danube waltz. It was her husband's favorite.
"You know," Hans explained to her, "he saved my life." The light in the room was small and the air restrained. "If there's anything you ever need..." He slid a piece of paper with his name and address on it across the table. "I'm a painter by trade. I'll paint your apartment for free, whenever you like." He knew it was useless compensation, but he offered anyway. The woman took the paper, and not long after, a small child wandered in and sat on her lap. "This is Max," the woman said, but the boy was too young and shy to say anything. He was skinny, with soft hair, and his thick, murky eyes watched as the stranger played one more song in the heavy room. From face to face, he looked on as the man played, and the woman wept. The different notes handled her eyes. Such sadness. Hans left.
"You never told me," he said to a dead Eric Vandenberg and the Stuttgart skyline. "You never told me you had a son."
After a momentary head-shaken stoppage, Hans returned to Munich, expecting never to hear from those people again. What he didn't know was that his help would most definitely be needed, but not for painting, and not for another 20 years or so. There were a few weeks before he started painting. In the good weather months he worked vigorously, and even in the winter he often said to Rosa that business might not be pouring, but it would at least drizzle now and again. For more than a decade, it all worked. Hans Jr. and Trudy were born. They grew up making visits to their papa at work, slapping paint on walls and cleaning brushes. When Hitler rose to power in 1933, though, the painting business fell slightly awry. Hans didn't join the NSDAP, like the majority of people did. He put a lot of thought into his decision. The thought process of Hans Hubermann. He was not well-educated or political, but if nothing else, he was a man who appreciated fairness. A Jew had once saved his life, and he couldn't forget that. He couldn't join a party that antagonized people in such a way. Also, much like Alex Steiner, some of his most loyal customers were Jewish. Like many of the Jews believed, he didn't think the hatred could last. And it was a conscious decision not to follow Hitler. On many levels, it was a disastrous one. Once the persecution began, his work slowly dried up. It wasn't too bad to begin with, but soon enough he was losing customers. Handfuls of quotes seemed to vanish into the rising Nazi air. He approached an old faithful named Herbert Bollinger, a man with a hemispheric waistline who spoke Hochdeutsch. He was from Hamburg, when he saw him on Munich Street. At first, the man looked down past his girth to the ground, but when his eyes returned to the painter, the question clearly made him uncomfortable. There was no reason for Hans to ask, but he did.
"What's going on, Herbert? I'm losing customers quicker than I can count."
Bollinger didn't flinch anymore. Standing upright, he delivered the fact as a question of his own. "Well, Hans, are you a member?"
"Of what?"
But Hans Hubermann knew exactly what the man was talking about.
"Come on, Hansi," Bollinger persisted. "Don't make me spell it out."
The tall painter waved him away and walked on. As the years passed by, the Jews were being terrorized at random throughout the country, and in the spring of 1937, almost to his shame, Hans Hubermann finally submitted. He made some inquiries and applied to join the party. After lodging his form at the Nazi headquarters on Munich Street, he witnessed four men throw several bricks into a clothing store named Kleinmann's. It was one of the few Jewish shops that were still in operation in Mulking. Inside, a small man was stuttering about, crushing the broken glass beneath his feet as he cleaned up. A star the colour of mustard was smeared to the door. In sloppy lettering, the words Jewish filth were spilling over at their edges. The movement inside tapered from hurried to morose, then stopped altogether. Hans moved closer and stuck his head inside. "Do you need some help?" Mr. Kleinman looked up. A dust broom was fixed powerlessly to his hand. "No, Hans, please, go away." Hans had painted Joel Kleinman's house the previous year. He remembered his three children. He could see their faces, but couldn't recall their names. "I will come tomorrow," he said, "and repaint your door." Which he did. It was the second of two mistakes. The first occurred immediately after the incident. He returned to where he'd come from and drove his fist onto the door and then the window of the NSDAP. The glass shuddered, but no one replied. Everyone had packed up and gone home. A last member was walking in the opposite direction. When he heard the rattle of the glass, he noticed the painter. He came back and asked what was wrong. "I can no longer join," Hans stated. The man was shocked. "Why not?" Hans looked at the knuckles of his right hand and swallowed. He could already taste the error, like a metal tablet in his mouth. "Forget it." He turned and walked home. Words followed him. "You just think about it, Herr Hubermann. Let us know what you decide." He did not acknowledge them. The following morning, as promised, he rose earlier than usual, but not early enough. The door at Kleinman's clothing was still moist with dew. Hans dried it. He managed to match the colour as close as humanly possible and gave it a good solid coat. Innocuously, a man walked past. "Heil Hitler," he said.
"Heil Hitler," Hans replied.
Three small but important facts. One, the man who walked past was Rolf Fischer, one of Mulking's greatest Nazis. Two, a new slur was painted on the door within 16 hours. Three, Hans Hubermann was not granted membership in the Nazi Party. Not yet, anyway. For the next year, Hans was lucky that he didn't revoke his membership application officially. While many people were instantly approved, he was added to a waiting list, regarded with suspicion. Toward the end of 1938, when the Jews were cleared out completely after Kristallnacht, the Gestapo visited. They searched the house, and when nothing or no one suspicious was found, Hans Hubermann was one of the fortunate. He was allowed to stay. What probably saved him was that people knew he was at least waiting for his application to be approved. For this he was tolerated, if not endorsed as the competent painter he was. Then there was his other saviour. It was the accordion that most likely spared him from total ostracism. Painters there were from all over Munich, but under the brief tutorage of Erich Vandenberg and nearly 2 decades of his own steady practice, there was no one in Mulking who could play exactly like him. It was a style not of perfection, but warmth. Even mistakes had a good feeling about them. He Heil Hitlered when it was asked of him, and he flew the flag on the right days. There was no apparent problem. Then, on June the 16th, 1939, the date was like cement now, just over 6 months after Liesel's arrival on Himmel Street, an event occurred that altered the life of Hans Hubermann irreversibly. It was a day in which he had some work. He left the house at 7 a.m. sharp. He towed his paint cart behind him, oblivious to the fact that he was being followed. When he arrived at the worksite, a young stranger walked up to him. He was blonde and tall and serious. The pair watched each other.
"Would you be Hans Hubermann?"
Hans gave him a single nod. He was reaching for a paintbrush.
"Yes, I would." "Do you play the accordion, by any chance?"
This time Hans stopped, leaving the brush where it was. Again he nodded. The stranger rubbed his jaw, looked around him, and then spoke with great quietness, yet great clarity.
"Are you a man who likes to keep a promise?"
Hans took out 2 paint cans and invited him to sit down. Before he accepted the invitation, the young man extended his hand and introduced himself.
My name's Kugler. Walter. I come from Stuttgart.
They sat and talked quietly for 15 minutes or so, arranging a meeting for later on, in the night. A Good Girl. In November 1940, when Max Vandenberg arrived in the kitchen of 33 Himmel Street, he was 24 years old. His clothes seemed to weigh him down, and his tiredness was such that an itch could break him in two. He stood shaking and shaken in the doorway.
"Do you still play the accordion?" Of course, the question was really, "Will you still help me?"
Liesl's papa walked to the front door and opened it. Cautiously, he looked outside, each way, and returned. The verdict was nothing. Max Vandenberg, the Jew, closed his eyes and drooped a little further into safety. The very idea of it was ludicrous, but he accepted it nonetheless. Hans checked that the curtains were properly closed. Not a crack could be showing. As he did so, Max could no longer bear it. He crouched down and clasped his hands. The darkness stroked him. His fingers smelt of suitcase, metal, Mein Kampf, and survival. It was only when he lifted his head that the dim light from the hallway reached his eyes. He noticed the pajamaed girl standing there in full view.
"Papa?"
Max stood up like a struck match. The darkness swelled now around him.
"Everything's fine, Liesl," Papa said. "Go back to bed."
She lingered a moment before her feet dragged from behind. When she stopped and stole one last look at the foreigner in the kitchen, she could decipher the outline of a book on the table.
"Don't be afraid," she heard Papa whisper. "She's a good girl."
For the next hour, the good girl lay wide awake in bed, listening to the quiet fumbling of sentences in the kitchen. One wild card was yet to be played. A Short History of the Jewish Fistfighter. Max Vandenberg was born in 1916. He grew up in Stuttgart. When he was younger, he grew to love nothing more than a good fistfight. He had his first bout when he was 11 years old and skinny as a whittled broom handle. Wenzel Gruber, that's who he fought. He had a smart mouth, that Gruber kid, and wire curly hair. The local playground demanded that they fight, and neither boy was about to argue. They fought like champions. For a minute. Just when it was getting interesting, both boys were hauled away by their collars. A watchful parent. A trickle of blood was dripping from Max's mouth. He tasted it, and it tasted good. Not many people who came from his neighborhood were fighters, and if they were, they didn't do it with their fists. In those days, they said the Jews preferred to simply stand and take things, take the abuse quietly, and then work their way back to the top. Obviously, every Jew is not the same. He was nearly 2 years old when his father died, shot to pieces on a grassy hill. When he was 9, his mother was completely broke. She sold the music studio that doubled as their apartment, and they moved to his uncle's house. There he grew up with 6 cousins who battered, annoyed, and loved him. Fighting with the oldest one, Isaac, was the training ground for his fist fighting. He was trounced almost every night. At 13, tragedy struck again when his uncle died. As percentages would suggest, his uncle was not a hothead like Max. He was the type of person who worked quietly away for very little reward. He kept to himself and sacrificed everything for his family. And he died of something growing in his stomach. Something akin to a poisoned bowling ball. As is often the case, the family surrounded the bed and watched him capitulate. Somehow, between the sadness and loss, Max Vandenberg, who was now a teenager with hard hands, blackened eyes, and a sore tooth, was also a little disappointed, even disgruntled. As he watched his uncle sink slowly into the bed,
he decided that he would never allow himself to die like that. The man's face was so accepting, so yellow and tranquil, despite the violent architecture of his skull, the endless jawline stretching for miles, the pop-up cheekbones, and the pothole eyes. So calm, it made the boy want to ask something. "Where's the fight?" he wondered. "Where's the will to hold on?" Of course, at 13, he was a little excessive in his harshness. He had not looked something like me in the face. Not yet. With the rest of them, he stood around the bed and watched the man die. A safe merge from life to death. The light in the window was grey and orange, the colour of summer's skin, and his uncle appeared relieved when his breathing disappeared completely. "When death captures me," the boy vowed, "he will feel my fist on his face." Personally, I quite like that, such stupid gallantry. Yes, I like that a lot. From that moment on, he started to fight with greater regularity. A group of die-hard friends and enemies would gather down at a small reserve on Staber Street, and they would fight in the dying light. Archetypal Germans, the odd Jew, the boys from the East, it didn't matter. There was nothing like a good fight to expel the teenage energy. Even the enemies were an inch away from friendship. He enjoyed the tight circles and the unknown, the bitter sweetness of uncertainty, to win or to lose. It was a feeling in the stomach that would be stirred around until he thought he could no longer tolerate it. The only remedy was to move forward and throw punches. Max was not the type of boy to die thinking about it. His favorite fight, now that he looked back, was fight number 5, against a tall, tough, rangy kid named Walter Kugler. They were 15. Walter had won all 4 of their previous encounters, but this time Max could feel something different. There was new blood in him, the blood of victory, and it had the capability to both frighten and excite. As always, there was a tight circle crowded around them. There was grubby ground, there were smiles practically wrapped around the onlooking faces. Money was clutched in filthy fingers, and the calls and cries were filled with such vitality that there was nothing else but this. God, there was such joy and fear there, such brilliant commotion. The two fighters were clenched with the intensity of the moment, their faces loaded up with expression, exaggerated with the stress of it, the wide-eyed concentration. After a minute or so of testing each other out, they began moving closer and taking more risks. It was a street fight, after all, not an hour-long title fight. They didn't have all day. "Come on, Max!" one of his friends was calling out. There was no breath between any of the words. "Come on, Maxi-Taxi! You've got him now! You've got him, Jew boy! You've got him! You've got him!" A small kid with soft tufts of hair, a beaten nose, and swampy eyes, Max was a good head shorter than his opposition. His fighting style was utterly graceless, all bent over, nudging forward, throwing fast punches at the face of Kugler. The other boy, clearly stronger and more skillful, remained upright, throwing jabs that constantly landed on Max's cheeks and chin. Max kept coming. Even with the heavy absorption of punches and punishment, he continued moving forward. Blood discolored his lips. It would soon be dried across his teeth. There was a great roar when he was knocked down. Money was almost exchanged. Max stood up. He was beaten down one more time before he changed tactics, luring Walter Kugler a little closer than he'd wanted to come. Once he was there, Max was able to apply a short, sharp jab to his face. It stuck exactly on the nose. Kugler, suddenly blinded, shuffled back, and Max seized his chance. He followed him over to the right and jabbed him once more and opened him up with a punch that reached into his ribs. The right hand that ended him landed on his chin. Walter Kugler was on the ground, his blonde hair peppered with dirt. His legs were parted in a V. Tears like crystal floated down his skin, despite the fact that he was not crying. The tears had been bashed out of him. The circle counted. They always counted, just in case. Voices and numbers.
The custom after a fight was that the loser would raise the hand of the victor. When Kugler finally stood up, he walked sullenly to Max Vandenberg and lifted his arm into the air. "Thanks," Max told him. Kugler proffered a warning. "Next time, I kill you." Altogether, over the next few years, Max Vandenberg and Walter Kugler fought 13 times. Walter was always seeking revenge for that first victory Max took from him, and Max was looking to emulate his moment of glory. In the end, the record stood at 10-3 for Walter. They fought each other until 1933, when they were 17. Grudging respect turned to genuine friendship, and the urge to fight left them. Both held jobs until Max was sacked with the rest of the Jews at the Jedermann engineering factory in 35. That wasn't long after the Nuremberg laws came in, forbidding Jews to have German citizenship, and for Germans and Jews to intermarry.
"Jesus," Walter said one evening when they met on the small corner where they used to fight. "That was a time, wasn't it? There was none of this around."
He gave the star on Max's sleeve a backhanded slap.
"We could never fight like that now."
Max disagreed.
"Yes, we could.
You can't marry a Jew, but there's no law against fighting one."
Walter smiled.
"There's probably a law rewarding it, as long as you win."
For the next few years, they saw each other sporadically at best. Max, with the rest of the Jews, was steadily rejected and repeatedly trodden upon, while Walter disappeared inside his job, a printing firm. If you're the type who's interested, yes, there were a few girls in those years. One named Tanya, the other Hildy. Neither of them lasted. There was no time, most likely due to the uncertainty and mounting pressure. Max needed to scavenge for work. What could he offer those girls? By 1938, it was difficult to imagine that life could get any harder. Then came November the 9th, Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass. It was the very incident that destroyed so many of his fellow Jews, but it proved to be Max Vandenberg's moment of escape. He was 22. Many Jewish establishments were being surgically smashed and looted, when there was a clatter of knuckles on the apartment door. With his aunt, his mother, his cousins and their children, Max was crammed into the living room.
"Aufmachen!"
The family watched each other. There was a great temptation to scatter into the other rooms, but apprehension is the strangest thing. They couldn't move. Again.
"Open up!"
Isaac stood and walked to the door. The wood was alive, still humming from the beating it had just been given. He looked back at the faces, naked with fear, turned the lock, and opened the door. As expected, it was a Nazi, in uniform.
"Never."
That was Max's first response. He clung to his mother's hand and that of Sarah, the nearest of his cousins.
"I won't leave. If we all can't go, I don't go either."
He was lying. When he was pushed out by the rest of his family, the relief struggled inside him like an obscenity. It was something he didn't want to feel, but nonetheless he felt it with such gusto it made him want to throw up. How could he? How could he? But he did.
"Bring nothing," Walter told him. "Just what you're wearing. I'll give you the rest."
"Max," it was his mother. From a drawer, she took an old piece of paper and stuffed it in his jacket pocket. "If ever..." She held him one last time by the elbows. "This could be your last hope." He looked into her aging face and kissed her very hard on the lips.
"Come on."
Walter pulled at him as the rest of the family said their goodbyes and gave him money and a few valuables.
"It's chaos out there, and chaos is what we need."
They left. Without looking back. It tortured him. If only he turned for one last look at his family as he left the apartment. Perhaps then the guilt would not have been so heavy. No final goodbye. No final grip of the eyes. Nothing but goneness. For the next 2 years, he remained in hiding, in an empty storeroom.
It was in a building where Walter had worked in previous years. There was very little food. There was plenty of suspicion. The remaining Jews with money in the neighborhood were emigrating. The Jews